Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Dan Zuba, and I recently graduated from the University of Akron School of Law. I also serve as the student liaison to the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society, as the Federalist Society takes no positions. Today's program is titled, From the Courthouse Steps, FCC v. AT&T. We're very pleased to welcome an excellent group of panelists. Thomas Berry is the director of the Cato Institute's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Before joining Cato, he was an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation and clerked for Judge E. Grady Jolly of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Josh Robbins is an attorney in Pacific Legal Foundation's Separation of Powers Group. Prior to joining Pacific Legal Foundation, Josh was an associate at a large law firm where he litigated cases in federal and state courts. He clerked for the Honorable Jerry E. Smith of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in Houston. One note for our audience before we begin. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later in the program. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to begin the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thomas, why don't you kick us off?
All right, fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Dan, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. It's always an honor to participate in these types of events. So today we're talking, as you said, about the FCC versus AT&T decision, which is a decision about the Seventh Amendment and whether this particular FCC procedure for both finding liability and then collecting money from people who violate or allegedly violate FCC rules and regulations, whether that comports with the Seventh Amendment. So as a brief refresher, Seventh Amendment says in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. And the big major case that's the background to all of this that all of our viewers need to keep in mind is, of course, the Jarkissi case from a couple years ago. That was about the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. But it was really a landmark case where the Supreme Court's analysis said in a typical agency adjudication where they are imposing punitive monetary fines on you, where they are taking money not just for the purpose of restitution, but to set an example and to dissuade other people from doing the same, where they are going through a civil process to punish you in some way, that is a suit at common law. They went through the history, they went through founding era precedents, founding era analogies, and they basically said, yes, a jury trial attaches to that. So the court in the Jarkissi decision 2 years ago invalidated what had been the SEC's process at the time, which was to find you liable not in federal court with an Article III judge and with a jury of your peers, but in an agency adjudication, either with an administrative law judge or with the commission itself, the SEC. And then you could appeal from that on questions of law to a court of appeals, but you never got a jury. You never got de novo factual review. So with that being the background, this was a challenge to the FCC's process. The underlying subject matter is about privacy rules. So Section 222 of 47 USC says that telecommunications carriers have a duty to protect the confidentiality of proprietary information of their customers. As everybody knows, when you download apps or sign up for cell phone service, you have to click yes to all sorts of signing away your rights and your privacies. And one of those is about location data. To what extent can they keep your location data? What can they use it for? What can they not use it for? So various telecom companies use this company called Securus as a third-party location data collector. And Securus had terms of service. They had things, they had reasons when they could validly give your location data over and reasons when they could not. And they said they would only give your location data over to law enforcement if they showed up with a warrant, if they had certain minimum standards. But a New York Times expose around 2018, 2019 said, in fact, there is an example where a Securus did not protect privacy, protect location data, as they should have. They actually turned it over to a sheriff who did not have a warrant, violating the terms of service. So once that came out, the FCC said these telecom carriers were on notice, that their customers' location data was not being protected adequately. The FCC alleged that the telecom carriers did not act quickly enough, and so they brought an action against them. They said, you violated the law, we're going to come after you and try to find you liable under Section 222. So they did against several telecom carriers, all the big ones, AT&T and Verizon are the two at issue here. They had an adjudication in-house in the agency, and this is before the Jarkissi decision, and they said, we have found you liable. And it's worth reading the text of what they sent to them, because it looks pretty scary when you get one of these. It doesn't look like the type of thing where you have many options. So after an in-house adjudication, again, without a jury, AT&T, for example, got a piece of paper that said, quote, in all caps and bold, it is ordered. And then back to lowercase, that pursuant to blah, 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 U.S. code, AT&T Inc., back to all caps and all bold, is liable for a monetary forfeiture, back to lowercase, in the amount of about $57 million for willfully and repeatedly violating Section 222 of the Act. So it doesn't sound like there's a lot of wiggle room there. Now, once that happens, once you get an order like that from the agency, from the FCC, you basically have two options. You can appeal directly to an appellate court. You don't get a jury in that circumstance. And the understanding at the time was you even have to pay to have the right to appeal. There's some dispute now whether that was true or not, but that was their understanding. So you can either appeal to an appellate court immediately, never get your jury right, or you can just wait and do nothing. And if you do that, then in theory, the Department of Justice is authorized to come collect. They can file a suit against you in a federal district court with venue pretty much everywhere, anywhere you do business. At any point between when you get this letter and 5 years in the future, that's the statute of limitations. And then if they bring that, then you get your de novo trial. So in practice, it seemed that no telecom company had ever waited for done that second option. They always appealed right away. That's what both of these companies at issue here did, AT&T and Verizon, AT&T to the Fifth Circuit, Verizon to the Second Circuit. In both of them, originally, the FCC resists the argument that the Seventh Amendment applies at all, but eventually they acquiesce. By the time it gets up to the Supreme Court, they've acquiesced on the Seventh Amendment as a basic point that it does apply, that this is a common law penalty action. So the issue now, the Fifth Circuit rules against the FCC, holds that you violated the Seventh Amendment, but the Second Circuit accepts the backup argument of the FCC. They say, yes, you need a jury trial at some point, but it's sufficient that you can, in theory, do that second option. If you wait and let DOJ sue you, then you get your jury trial, and that's sufficient. So that's the issue as it goes up to the Supreme Court. Is this wait, let DOJ potentially sue you within 5 years, is that sufficient to get you the jury trial that you need under the Seventh Amendment? It goes up to the Supreme Court. There's oral argument, which I attended. It seems to go actually fairly well for the government, but a lot of it is simply getting deep into the weeds of, well, what is the actual force, if anything, of this order that you get? It sure looks scary. Does it give you a stigma? Does it potentially carry, do the facts found, could it potentially have interest accruing against you? Could it be used in future penalties as sort of proof that you're a repeat offender? Those were the types of things at issue. And AT&T's lawyer basically repeatedly said, look, the only way that this could possibly be permissible without a jury is if it's not even a paper tiger, but literally just a piece of paper. So that set the stage for the opinion, which we got last week. And I'll hand it over to Josh.
Thanks, Tommy, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate. So the Supreme Court, in its opinion last week, ended up siding with the Second Circuit, and it basically said that the this forfeiture order from the FCC under the statute was just a piece of paper, and it analogized it to other kinds of case-initiating documents like an indictment or a right-to-sue letter, because according to the court, under the statute, the order did not definitively resolve the party's legal obligations, and the commission's factual findings were not conclusive. So just to hit some of the high points from the court's opinion, The court reiterated that the jury trial rights are broadly available in any case settling legal rights, regardless of the form, but that the Seventh Amendment does not guarantee a jury trial at the beginning of any of these processes. Just at some point during the process, before the final determinations are made, the jury has to make the ultimate determination of issues of fact. And it cited two older precedents, one from an agency fact determination that a court reviewed de novo, and another from a district court appointing an auditor that it had signed off on had de novo jury trial review as a basis for this. And here, with respect to the FCC order, the court said that three features of it meant that it wasn't legally binding before this after the fact de novo jury trial that the DOJ can initiate. The FCC couldn't execute on the forfeiture order to collect the fines. There was no penalty for non-payment of the fines, and the FCC couldn't hold against the carriers the fact that the forfeiture order had been issued unless the carriers paid or this later court process enforced the order. And on the fact-finding question, since the statute, the court said, offered a trial de novo, and that was understood to let the court determine anew both issues of law and fact, the carriers would get a fresh jury trial on everything, including the facts having to do with the case. The court then went through the petitioner's arguments and rejected them. As Tommy said, there's some daunting, scary language in the order and the statute indicating that this might be legally binding. But the court swept this aside and said that it couldn't be considered legally binding because there was no enforcement mechanism, regardless of what these orders said. And for that reason, the court also said that this FCC order was not comparable to Jarkissi and the SEC scheme because the SEC's penalties in Jarkissi that the court said violated the Seventh Amendment were immediately enforceable through proceedings like garnishment. And then, as I said at the top, the court analogized these letters to these orders to a right to sue letter and said that that was not not something that had any legal effect because it didn't come to a final determination of the carrier's legal obligations, and it pushed to one side the carrier's arguments that they were suffering practical harms from having been found to have violated the statutes and the regulations here, because such practical harms, the court says, come at any preliminary stage of a proceeding, such as if you were criminally indicted and got bad press because of that. The carriers also had a backup argument that this structure violated the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. So this is a doctrine the court has recognized in a variety of contexts that the constitutional rights, the exercise of constitutional rights or privileges or benefits can't be conditioned on someone having to waive one of their constitutional rights in the process. Here, the carriers argued that the costs of having to wait for DOJ to maybe in 5 years bring a collection action for them to get a jury trial basically coerced them into pursuing the Court of Appeals review process in which a jury trial wasn't available. But the court rejected this argument because, as it had found in the previous section, the Seventh Amendment right did not even attach to these orders because they, according to the court's interpretation, were non-binding. They couldn't be used against the carrier. The fact determinations had no preclusive effect after the fact. And the court again rejected this reputational harm argument that the carriers put forward. This time it compared the risks and the coercive effects to its prior cases, signing off on situations in which the exercise of the Sixth Amendment jury trial right in the criminal context could result in higher penalties vis-a-vis plea bargaining. And the court said if that was okay, which it had said in the past, then whatever coercive effect might exist here was certainly not enough. So I'll toss it back to Tommy to talk through Justice Thomas's dissent.
All right. Well, I'll be brief because it's a brief dissent. Even Justice Thomas does not disagree with the majority's view or the majority's new reading of this statute, that there's no preclusive effect. There's no stigma. There's no teeth whatsoever to these orders from the FCC. Justice Thomas's point is really just one of fairness. He makes the case that that was not at all clear before this decision. So he said that rewinding the clock back to when they got these letters, when AT&T and Verizon, et cetera, got these letters, this is before Jarkissi. This is when the FCC had not yet conceded that the Seventh Amendment applied. And this is when, in Justice Thomas's view, the statute was far from clear that you, in fact, would get de novo factual review if you waited the 5 years. So Justice Thomas says the only fair thing to do is rewind the clock and give the carriers the choice all over again. Let them give them their money back and let them decide if they want to take this alternate route, because that's not a choice they have now, given the court's decision. The court's view is essentially you could have gotten your jury, but you chose not to, and we're not going to let you go back and make that decision over again. So I think Justice Thomas has a fair point in my view, which is that maybe now in the future, companies will view this as a paper tiger, and that's all well and good that they've taken all the teeth out of this and made clear for the future that there's no stigma. That doesn't really resolve the harm suffered by the companies in the past, who would have felt very nervous about making that choice. So, Josh, what do you make of this decision?
Yeah, I think, it's basically unanimous on the law, notwithstanding Justice Thomas's practical point. And, you know, I think if you accept the justice's view of this as some kind of non-binding case initiating letter, it's probably right that I think that makes sense for how the Seventh Amendment operates. I think in a practical sense, it's going to be a tough decision on, you know, on Americans and companies to implement, because as Tommy pointed out, you get these notices that have all this language that seems legally binding, and this decision, you know, sort of invites companies and Americans to flout these orders and, you know, wait for DOJ to come after them. And that's, you know, even if that's right under the Seventh Amendment, that's a bit of an awkward set of incentives. But I think there are two silver linings to this, just briefly. The court, you know, does say very firmly that there has to be some kind of de novo factual review at some point in the process under the Seventh Amendment. In Jarkissi, and I think we'll see in the future, the Seventh Amendment analysis is going to be tied really closely to whether or not there is Article III jurisdiction over cases, and the court seems inclined to clamp down on that. And this suggests to me that the substantial review standard for evidentiary review in the appellate review model might be under threat in cases going forward that are equitable rather than common law. And the court might think that judges have to make those fact decisions anew in those cases as well. And the court also implicitly applies the unconstitutional conditions doctrine to the Seventh Amendment here. It didn't outright say that the unconstitutional conditions doctrine didn't apply. It actually analyzed it. And so I think that's going to be important in challenges to the constitutionality of FINRA and cases like I'm litigating against the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority, where you have private entities that have some sort of nominal registration requirement that the government argues is a waiver of your Seventh Amendment rights. But the unconstitutional conditions doctrine can even more clearly than it did before come in and combat that waiver argument.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point to flag, and something that might not be apparent from the face of the opinion at first. To me, my frustration with this is the same as my frustration more broadly with so-called constitutional avoidance decisions, which I think this fits very comfortably in. And in fact, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson had, I thought, a very good dissent in one from a couple years ago about the statute making it a crime to encourage violations of immigration law, which the Supreme Court narrowed essentially to get it within constitutional bounds. And as Justice Jackson pointed out, the government kind of gets to have it both ways. They apply statutes maximally to scare people right up until the point where it's challenged as unconstitutional. And then they change their tune when they're on the back foot, interpret it minimally, and get it just narrow enough to survive and continue. But that doesn't reverse the fact that they enforced it maximally for however many years and coerced people to in this case, unanimously pay as soon as they got these letters rather than risking non-payment. The AT&T's brief at one point said that the government treats these companies as if they're the so-called Holmesian bad man. People might remember the Oliver Wendell Holmes theory from law school that the law should treat people as if they were a bad man who just thinks about what are the actual concrete penalties I receive from breaking the law, not about some abstract stigma. It even reminds me a little bit of the Obamacare decision, to be honest, where the Supreme Court reread a penalty as a tax in such a way that there's no stigma to not buying health insurance, with Justice Roberts even saying he thought it was implausible that a statute would make outlaws of millions of people, which was the prediction for how many would not buy insurance. Similarly here, AT&T's brief said, how plausible is it that, you would write a statute that expects companies to be scofflaws and ignore these letters? Well, now that's basically the Supreme Court is just reassured, no, we're going to narrow this and read this in a way that, don't worry, you're not a scofflaw. You're just being the rational actor ignoring this, and there's no stigma whatsoever. But that doesn't go back and fix it. And the last point I'll make is that what you mentioned, the analogy to coercive plea bargaining and plea agreements, well, I think the Supreme Court takes one step too many when they say, of course, that's fine, so this must be fine. We at Cato have been criticizing coercive plea bargaining for quite a while, and I think this is another example where the bad precedent of assuming coercive plea bargaining is fine leads to other incorrect assumptions. So we hope eventually the Supreme Court will reconsider whether that fundamental premise is correct in the first place.
Well, guys, I want to just hop in for a second and just remind our audience, if you have any questions, please type them into Zoom's Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. I think we're ready to move to Q&A, so I'll just start with the first question. Are there any other agencies that have a similar system to this where they send a letter saying you owe and you don't have to pay until the DOJ sues you?
Yeah, there are. And I think that's one of the most practically useful things for people to know and be aware of coming out of this opinion. So the FCC, the telecom companies had said, well, wait, if this argument is right, why was Jarkissi right? But as Josh mentioned, Jarkissi, the SEC scheme, that was different. That was not like this because the government could start garnishing money through taxes or other means without this kind of lawsuit. But if people are interested, it's on page 33 of the government's brief in this case. They list out the other procedures that are, at least in the government's view, like this one here. So unlike the SEC one in Jarkissi, they say there are five agencies with 11 other enforcement statutes that, like this one, you're found liable, but then you don't actually have to pay until the government sues you. So the five agencies are, there's some from Department of Energy, Department of HHS, Customs Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, and FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So kind of a random grab bag, but if people are interested, they can look at page 33 of the government's brief. Presumably, the reasoning of this opinion here means that all 11 of those statutes that the government lists are also okay. So people should be aware, I think, that the logic of this extends now to those as well. If you get this kind of scary letter, but you don't have to pay until an enforcement suit is brought, you now know there's no stigma to not paying and waiting to get your jury trial.
Thank you. Here's another question. Will the Seventh Amendment argument apply to the states?
It will take a different case to do that. That gets into the question of incorporation doctrine and whether or not the 14th Amendment, when it was enacted after the Civil War, actually extended the Bill of Rights to the states. So that's happened for a lot of different rights. So the most recent right that was incorporated was the Second Amendment right. But the Seventh Amendment is actually not one that has been incorporated against the states yet. While many states have jury trial rights, the Seventh Amendment itself doesn't apply. So there's a lot of ongoing litigation about that, including my colleagues at PLF. So we'll have to see.
Josh, can you just speak to some of the broader policy implications of this ruling?
Yeah, I think going forward, queuing off what Tommy said about the constitutional avoidance arguments, I think for cases going before the court on these structural constitutional questions, I think this sort of reinforces that the court is going to really make an effort to interpret the statute in a way that avoids a constitutional problem. This kind of aligns with the FCC versus Consumers Research opinion we saw last year, where the court decided that the Universal Service Fund, also at the FCC, did not violate the non-delegation doctrine. But in doing so, it tightened up some of its precedents about how the non-delegation doctrine works and what a statute must do, and then gave teeth to the way the Universal Service Fund statute was written in a way, again, like here, that might not have been immediately obvious to everyone who was actually operating under the statute before the Supreme Court went about it this way. So I think this indicates that by granting this case, and next term they're going to consider a case called Sun Valley Orchards about agency adjudication as well, that the court's interested in these issues. And these, I think these structures are definitely going to be closely scrutinized by the court, but the court is going to do everything it can to interpret the statute in a way that is as narrow as possible to avoid reaching a constitutional question.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I do think there's a potential also going forward. The companies didn't raise other questions about, now that we know, okay, you get de novo in this trial, is there any other option besides waiting the full 5 years? Could there be an option to bring a declaratory judgment suit? Could you bring some kind of due process claim that 5 years is just too long to wait in limbo? I mean, the analogy is to an indictment, but in the criminal context, it would be violation of due process and speedy trial to be indicted and then say, oh, we'll maybe enforce it within the next 5 years, but who knows when. So not totally certain but I still think people should treat those as open questions, because they just weren't raised in this case. This is just the more basic question of, is this type of structure where the ball goes into the government's court basically constitutional, as long as it really is de novo?
How about this? Are there cases attempting to use state law to apply the right to a jury trial to professional licensure cases?
There actually is. I know one of my colleagues here at PLF has just argued a case before the Nevada Supreme Court called Hagen, in which it involves the Nevada Board of Architecture and an architecture licensing scheme with an out-of-state architect being pursued by the Nevada Board of Architecture for unauthorized practice. So in that case, there are Nevada civil jury trial claims and then a Seventh Amendment claim as well. And in the background, that's one of those potential cases that might raise the incorporation issue that I talked about before.
And one wrinkle also raised by this opinion just briefly is they actually bring up the $20 clause, which I can't remember another Seventh Amendment case that ever raised that, where the Supreme Court basically says, yes, you raise these sort of non-monetary potential harms of being held in limbo, but it says $20 right in there. You got to be able to put a more concrete dollar amount to it. So I don't know whether this will make it somewhat harder for people in cases about, abstract but still real harms, whether that's stigma, right to earn a living, et cetera. It feels like you have to put a lot of work when you're thinking about these into putting a dollar amount that's more concrete on this.
Yeah, the one thing that might help there is that a lot of these agency adjudication schemes often pair financial penalties with some kind of suspension or industry bar order. And luckily, under pretty well-established Supreme Court precedent in a case called Dairy Queen, you still get a jury trial on the facts that relate to that monetary penalty, even if there's something that's equitable as well. So that may not apply in every situation. As we were discussing here, the carriers were kind of boiled down to reputational harm by the court's interpretation practice or interpretation of the statute. But that at least leaves the door open for people to bring these claims in a variety of places.
Well, guys, this has been such an interesting conversation, and thank you to our audience for asking such great questions. I wanted to thank our panelists for sharing their expertise and opinions on this very important issue. If our audience is interested in learning more about all the Federal Society's programming, please visit their website at fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.